I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Maddie Friedman, prominent Israeli journalist and author of Pumpkin Flowers and the Aleppo Codex. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Baruch Kachar, and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We are in a period of time between Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day, and Yom Yerushalayim, the holiday that celebrates the reunification of Jerusalem in 1967. This year, we'll remember a very special date, the 50th anniversary of the victory in the Six-Day War that returned the old city of Jerusalem to Israeli hands, allowing us once again to pray at the Western Wall, and that united the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Last week, we discussed the build-up to that war and the extraordinary victory that transformed Israel from a tiny, surrounded state to a larger, more defensible nation. Today and next week, we'll look at the effects of that victory on Israel and Jews around the world and explore just what this milestone anniversary means. But first, I must note that the actual Six-Day War took place in June of 1967, with the reunification of Jerusalem occurring following its capture from the Jordanian army on June 7, 1967. So why are we talking about it now? Well, on the Hebrew calendar, that date, the 29th of Iyar, falls this year on May 25th. There's plenty to discuss when we reflect on this 50th anniversary, and we will probably still be discussing it in June, but the Jewish calendar anniversary is the one observed in Israel, so we'll start now. While Israeli forces miraculously captured the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, and the West Bank in just 6 days of war, today I'll start by talking about Jerusalem itself. As many of you know, Yerushalayim consisted then as now of two major parts, the walled Old City, pretty small, and the modern New City, both East and West Jerusalem. The new city is much larger and much more populous. It's the section of the City of Peace. That's what Ir Shalom, the source word for Yerushalayim, means. By the way, that's not an accurate name historically. Jerusalem has been attacked 52 times, conquered militarily 44 times, besieged 23 times, and totally destroyed several times, just within the realm of what's recorded in history, not going back earlier. In 586 BCE, the Babylonians, under Nebuchadnezzar, more than 2,500 years ago, razed Jerusalem. In the year 70, the Roman general and later emperor Titus destroyed it also, and destroyed the temple for good. And then Jerusalem was partially destroyed again in 135 by Hadrian at the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt. The Mongols destroyed at least most of it in the year 1260. This magnificent city, unlike any in the world, has had a hard life. But the last time Jerusalem was captured is now 50 years ago this month. What you might not know or think about is that besides the new city and the old city, Jerusalem is ringed by many neighborhoods, both east and west. They are not really suburbs, since they are very much part of the city, but they spread all around its edges of this capital city of Israel. Many of the neighborhoods to the east of the old city are Arab, either Muslim or Christian Arabs, and there are also Arab villages that lie very close to the middle of Jerusalem. Almost all of the neighborhoods to the west are Jewish, including large housing areas built on land that became part of Israel in 1967. When people in media or politics complain about Israeli settlement building, often they are really talking about housing units in established Jewish neighborhoods all around Jerusalem that just happened to lie on land that wasn't officially part of Israel prior to 1967. No one really expects Israel to hand over these areas to any future Palestinian state. there would be, if it ever happened, land swaps. And adding homes in these neighborhoods is not some sort of deliberate provocation or justification for terrorism against innocent Israelis. They are part of Jewish Jerusalem and will remain so. The heart of Yerushalayim is the amazing Old City. The Old City itself is confined within walls built by the Turkish Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent around the year 1540. It has less than a third of a square mile contained within those walls, but within that very small area it has three of the most sacred sites in the whole world: the Kotel, the Western Wall Plaza, the Temple Mount with the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Standing on the roof of the Austrian Hospice in the Christian Quarter, you can easily see parts of all three: the holiest Jewish place in the world, the holiest Christian place in the world, and the third holiest, approximately, Muslim place in the world. The Kotel is next to Al-Aqsa and just below the Dome of the Rock. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is just 1,500 feet away, less than a third of a mile to walk. Proximity does not necessarily breed peace in this Ir Shalom. Today, however, under Israel's overall authority, all holy sites are fully accessible to the faithful of their religion, as they have been in the 50 years since the end of the Six-Day War. The Old City is divided into four quarters of somewhat unequal size and very different population. The small Armenian quarter is devoted primarily to buildings and clergy of the Armenian Orthodox Christian Patriarchate. The Christian quarter is primarily, well, filled with Christian Arabs, and as you would expect, it holds many churches and international Christian organizations and entities, as well as shops and restaurants and houses. The Muslim quarter is larger and busier and more atmospheric than the Christian quarter, and it has the famous Shuk marketplace. The Jewish quarter was totally destroyed by the Jordanians after the Israelis had to surrender the Old City to their Jordanian army in 1948. But it has been and continues to be rebuilt magnificently, and the Jewish quarter has grown substantially in population since 1967. But overall, the Old City is small compared to the large modern city that now surrounds it. All told, only about 40,000 or so of Jerusalem's over 800,000 residents live in the Old City. While most of the extensive territory Israel captured in 1967 was not formally annexed to Israel, the thinking even then was that Israel would trade captured land for peace treaties with the surrounding Arab nations. The Old City, including the holiest places on earth for Jews, the Temple Mount and the Kotel, the Western Wall, were fully annexed into Israel. That is not likely to change. And 50 years after that annexation, the Old City remains the epicenter of religious energy for Jews, Christians, Muslims, and others. For many Muslims, Jerusalem is called Al-Quds, which means the Holy One. Quds, like Kadosh, kind of the same word. And East Jerusalem, including the Old City, should become the capital of a new state of Palestine. In the 1990s, the Oslo peace process attempted to create movement towards a final settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. It made remarkable progress for some time, mostly because the leaders who created it left the hardest question of all: just what would happen to East Jerusalem, and especially the Old City of Jerusalem, with its centrally sacred places as the last item to be negotiated. In effect, they believed that when they had resolved nearly all the rest of the issues, they would then decide how to divide responsibility for Jerusalem. Well, they never got there. Palestinian terrorism and security differences destroyed the peace process before any decisions needed to be made about Jerusalem. Still, it's hard to see how they could have ever resolved any division of this Old City. To play us in this morning, here's Naomi Shemer's iconic Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, written just before the Six-Day War in 1967, revised just after, kind of a national song for Israel, sung by its original vocal artist, Shuli Natan, past guest of Two Jewish. ותרדמת אילן ואבן שבויה בחלומה העיר אשר בדד יושבת ובליבה חומה
Yerushalayim shel zahav veshel nechoshet veshel or anu lechol shirayich ani kinor Yerushalayim shel zahav veshel nechoshet veshel or anu lechol Shubrot ha-mayim Kikar ha-shuk reka Ve'in pokedet har-habayit Ba'ir ha-adika Uva me'arot asher vasela Me'alelot ruchot Ve'in yored el yam ha-melach Bederech yericho Yerushalayim shel zahav veshel nechoshet veshel or halo lechol shirayich ani kinor Yerushalayim shel zahav veshel nechoshet veshel or halo lechol
That was Shuli Natan singing Naomi Shemer's Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, Jerusalem of Gold, for the upcoming 50th anniversary of the reunification of Jerusalem, Yom Yerushalayim. Our guest this morning, prominent Israeli journalist Mati Friedman, has written a fascinating new book called Pumpkin Flowers about his experience fighting in Lebanon with the IDF. The author of the Aleppo Codex and an authority with insight into the sources of anti-Israel bias in the media, he's a fascinating guy. Meet him when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. He's the distinguished journalist and author, Mati Friedman. His first book, The Aleppo Codex, won the 2014 Sammy Rohr Prize, the American Library Association's Sophie Brody Medal, and a whole bunch of other honors about the fascinating subject of one of the oldest texts of the Torah of Jewish scripture ever. His more recent book, Pumpkin Flowers, about his own personal memoir of a traumatic and powerful experience of war, and his reporting on media bias towards Israel has provoked, well, I would say, an internet storm at several junctures. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write Pumpkin Flowers.
When I arrived in Israel as a 17-year-old in the mid-1990s, I decided that I was going to stay here. I'd grown up in Toronto, and I decided that I'd rather live in Israel. And after becoming a citizen, I was drafted, which is what happens here in a country with a compulsory draft. And in 1997, I found myself in the military, engaged in a very strange, small guerrilla war in South Lebanon. And this conflict, about which very little has been written, was one of the defining events of the 1990s. I think you can describe it as the first war of the 21st century, and had many of the characteristics that we now associate with war, and wars in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So I had a formative experience in this strange conflict in an outpost inside South Lebanon. The outpost was called Outpost Pumpkin, and I was, of course, deeply influenced by my experience there. And as years went on after my military service and after the end of this war in South Lebanon, which ended with a unilateral withdrawal in the spring of 2000, and as the years went on, I realized that these experiences were important not just to me, but for anyone trying to understand Israel in the 21st century, anyone trying to understand the Middle East in 2017. And I thought it would be useful to try to write something about it, and that turned into Pumpkin Flowers.
Now, pumpkin, you know, flowers are the military euphemism for casualties. Can you make the case that this was an experience of just the waste of this, of the whole process?
It's a bit more complicated, at least from my perspective. The engagement, or Israel's engagement inside Lebanon, begins in the late 1960s with raids into Israel by Palestinian organizations operating out of Lebanon. And over a period of years, Israel kind of gets drawn into Lebanon in an attempt to protect Israel's northern border. And this culminates in the famous and ultimately disastrous invasion of 1982. Israel invades Lebanon and tries to push the Palestinians out and kind of gets embroiled in internal Lebanese conflict. In 1985, so this is 3 years after the invasion, Israel withdraws to a strip of land along the border that it calls the security zone, which is a buffer zone meant to protect the border. And if you have a chaotic situation on the other side of a border, you can either try to protect the border by being on the border, which is hard, or you can try to protect the border by being inside the other country on the other side of the border, and that's what Israel chose to do. And as the 90s wore on, and the war in Lebanon against a group called Hezbollah, which is a Shia group affiliated with Iran, as that war became more and more costly, more and more Israelis began to question whether the benefits of defending the border from inside Lebanon were outweighed by the cost, by the increasingly steep cost of maintaining the security zone. And in 1997, the number of Israeli fatalities in Lebanon was over 100, in part because of a tragic helicopter accident en route to our outpost, Outpost Pumpkin, and another nearby outpost. And that ended up being the turning point when Israelis decided that it just wasn't worth the cost. And protest movement started after that helicopter crash in 1997, and the movement was run by four mothers of military-aged children, and the protesters gained more and more support until the army ultimately pulled everyone out in the spring of 2000.
We will explore this in much greater depth, and also both the Aleppo Codex and your perspective on PD bias towards Israel when we return in just a few moments with author and journalist Mati Friedman. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking broadly about the rise of authoritarianism, dealt last week specifically with Turkey and Erdogan. You know, I was in Hungary not too long ago, and there Viktor Orban has done kind of the same things, abolished most of the independence of the other aspects of government, controlled the press. There's almost no free press where it was once quite vigorous there. France, you know, this bulwark of liberty, equality, fraternity, now it's turning kind of authoritarian too, or it appears to be.
Right. The whole concept of human rights, in fact, was born in France, and all kinds of slogans about liberty and welcoming political refugees and being a shelter for people who were persecuted elsewhere, blah, blah, blah. That was always typical of France, although American Jews don't necessarily see France in that light. Historically, that was a very accurate portrayal of France. But again, France is not immune from global trends. And I think one of the things that has troubled France is the decline of certain French institutions that were very particularistic, like the cafe, the bistro. These things have been replaced by McDonald's and fast food. And the rest of the world may take that in stride, but the French find cause for alarm in those developments and the increasing prevalence of English as the international language. English has long since replaced French. It's dislodged
French.
Yeah,
it's not the lingua franca anymore. It's really the English language that's the international language.
And, you know, even though France was technologically way ahead of us in terms of they had something called the Minitel long before we had email, which was kind of a primitive version of email. All these changes caused distress. France was primarily and traditionally an agricultural country, small farmholders, small landowners, still arguably, and I know that as a Californian this terribly offends you, but arguably the producer of the best wines in the world. And all these traditional values have been under assault for the past 50 years. And the first strong reaction you saw to this, I think, was probably 30 years ago when the current Le Pen's father created something called the National Front, which was a far-right sort of neo-Nazi party, kind of overtly.
And anti-Semitic,
engaged in Holocaust denial. Absolutely. And all kinds of other things. And his daughter has disowned some of this rhetoric, but he also employed some of it.
Yeah, he was expelled from the National Front himself, the party he founded. But she kind of cozies up on some of that too, doesn't she?
Yep. Le Pen II is very much a force to be reckoned with.
You know, it's so strange. We have this weird perception in America that everybody is going to eventually be democratic or that the world will go in that direction. And it's not a necessary condition around the world.
Absolutely not.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi Nan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Israel is in the media a lot around the world and in America, not always fairly portrayed. Let's discuss that a little bit.
To say the least. So to answer this question and other, first of all, I welcome everyone to join us today at 5 p.m. for a free Israeli dinner and conversation with a former AP reporter, Matti Friedman, who wrote two books about, you know, why Israel presented
about
in
Israel
media.
In the media,
yeah,
essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah, should be great. And where is that going to be at the
JCC? It will be at Chofetz Chaim. It's co-sponsored by the Israel Center in Chofetz Chaim, part of 3 weeks of Tucson Celebrates Israel. And actually, we heard them in Israel. And even as an Israeli, I wasn't with a group of American from Tucson, of course, but as an Israeli, it was eye-opening because I've never thought about a very simple, not to say almost stupid explanation, that so many, like 50 reporters, been sent to the Middle East to report about the Middle East. The minority of them would like to be in Beirut or in Syria. The majority would like to be in Tel Aviv, right?
Of course.
So here you have 50 reporters in the same small, tiny country, not to say tiny Tel Aviv, trying to report, you know, and make a salary out of it and saying 10,000 happy people woke up this morning in Jerusalem doesn't make news, right?
Right, right. Reporting on, oh, there's a great gay pride parade and everybody's having a wonderful time.
Yeah,
that's
no
not
casualty,
news.
Nothing, no rockets. No. You know, it's
They have lots of great restaurants in Tel Aviv. Yeah, so that's not news.
That's an amazing sentence that's stuck in my head from Matti, along with other things, but I don't want to give you to the whole lecture,
don't give
right?
us the whole thing away. Let people come tonight.
But first, that's a very, you know, people doesn't think like on why. Like they just get, you know, Israel did this and this without thinking what came before, what's the history, what's the background, what the other side did. I'm not saying Israel is a saint, we're not, but we definitely, this will allow people to get a broader picture, a bigger picture, and really try more than understand. I don't know that you really can understand in 1 hour Israel, but at least be open that there is more than one story here, that if you really, really want to have an opinion about Israel or Middle East, you need to take some time to really, and savlanut, to learn.
To think and pay attention, not just consider
yourself maven after, you know, 5 seconds of article in whatever channel.
Right, or something comes across your news feed, yes, on Facebook, and now you think you know everything there is to know about Israel.
Yes.
Thank you, Ashrada. You know, perhaps the greatest lesson is to pay attention and to know there's complexity. The Middle East is always complicated, and Israel is not so simple either.
Nachon. And we are young. Still young.
Still young. Thanks, Ashrada. We'll talk next week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or, Rabbi.
You are taking a large group from Tucson Hebrew Academy, your graduating class, to,
yes,
Israel.
Yes.
It's very exciting. And so I have to ask a question that I get asked from time to time. I know you do. What's the right age to take kids to Israel if you're Jewish or just because you want to take kids,
yeah,
to Israel?
You know, it's an important question, and I love being asked this question when it comes up. We are thrilled to be taking 22 of our 23 eighth grade graduates this year to our annual Israel experience. And it's a great age for them, but not just because they're 14, more or less, years old, but also because they've had so much background in education preceding the trip. So what I like to tell people is there's never a bad time to go to Israel. If you can go to Israel, go to Israel. It's an amazing experience. And of course, like travel everywhere, you bring your perspective with you and you experience what's happening through that kind of a lens. So for example, our 14-year-olds have, many of them, you know, been through THA since kindergarten. So they've had years and years of buildup to this. There's educational information, history, facts, culture, food,
music.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So they've experienced so much about Israel here in Tucson, and now they get to take that with them. They've also gone through their bar and bar mitzvah years, and as they have grown up and become very sophisticated in terms of critical thinking and reading great literature, there's a lot going on in their minds. So for them, they're really primed for this trip. You know, I went my first time when I was 16, mm-hmm, and I had kind of a mixed experience. But having been there, fortunately, many times afterwards, each experience was a little bit different. I went again as a young adult about to be married, and I just had the good fortune of going last year as a, you know, as a 48-year-old and chaperoning.
You're so young.
Chaperoning the trip last year and got to see it through the lens of our students, as well as my, you know, coming back to Israel after maybe 20 years.
You know, people nowadays often say, oh, well, we'll just wait for birthright and they can go for free in college. Mm-hmm. But it's such a different experience. I went when I was 15, kind of like, yeah, you, spent a summer there, mixed, although generally great experience.
Yeah.
I remember bringing all three of my kids on a trip to Israel, and the youngest at the time was 6, mm-hmm, and she doesn't really remember very much,
right,
except that she liked it. You know,
yeah,
it's different at every stage.
Yeah, one of our kindergartners went this year and got to meet his counterpart class as part of our partnership program.
Right, and that's what he'll remember.
And that was awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it kind of depends who you are, where you're at in life, but there's never a bad time to go to Israel.
Couldn't agree more, and we will talk next week.
All right, have a great week. Shavua Tov, everybody.
Nesia Tova, a great trip.
Thank you.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A German visitor comes to New York and stays with Abe and his family. The first morning, they all have breakfast together, and Abe serves bagels and lox. The German exclaims in delight, "Wow, we don't have bagels like this in Germany." And Abe stands up and yells, "And whose fault is that?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the Seder of Bahar B'chukotai, the double portion at the end of the book of Leviticus. In these final sections of the middle book of the Torah, there are interesting oddities and lessons, both at the beginning and end of each portion. Bahar begins with the statement, "God spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying," seemingly unambiguous phrase. And at the end of the opening covenantal section of B'chukotai, the Torah reiterates that God gave all the regulations and laws contained here at Mount Sinai. Finally, B'chukotai concludes the book of Vayikra, telling us, "These are the commandments God commanded Moses for the Israelites on Mount Sinai." Well, all well and good, these rules of holiness and personal conduct must have been commanded at Mount Sinai, right? Yet earlier in Leviticus, it's pretty clear that God has given most of these commandments not at Sinai itself, but in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, as the people wander around the peninsula. In fact, the whole book of Leviticus is apparently given after we leave Sinai and have begun our journey to the promised land. Clearly, as Bahar begins, the Israelites don't actually seem to still be at Mount Sinai at all. So what gives? That question troubles rabbinic commentators who believe that the Torah never wastes a phrase or makes a mistake. Their brilliant answer teaches us a profound truth. In the rabbinic understanding, Mount Sinai is not just a geographical location, not a simple matter of a specific place at all. Wherever we learn and do mitzvot, whenever we complete ethical acts, do tzedakah, observe religious rituals with sanctity and meaning, study Torah, or work to perfect the world through tikkun olam, wherever and whenever we strive to make the world a holier, more Jewish place, then we are standing at Sinai. Almost literally, as committed Jews, we take Mount Sinai with us, bring God's very presence into the world. Powerful message indeed. As we conclude the book of Leviticus, focused fully on creating holiness, we learn that we can make our own lives holy, just as holy as the revelation at Mount Sinai, simply by studying and living Torah each day. May we each remember to do so today. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Mati Friedman, will explain what his best-selling memoir, Pumpkin Flowers, is all about and why it took him years to produce it, and how many journalists' views of Israel are shaped by factors that have nothing to do with the political situation at all. Find out what they are when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high school, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
For For the very first time in Israeli history, a top member of the IDF High Command revealed last week that he is openly gay. Military Advocate General and Brigadier General Sharon Afek told the Israel Bar Association's magazine that even though currently there are pockets of ignorance and hatred, the IDF accepts him and he has never experienced discrimination. Afek added that, "I never felt discriminatory or preferred treatment due to my sexual orientation as a factor in decisions the Army made on whether to promote him or not, and that is a positive. When I was a young officer, times were different, and I worried that the issue would be used against me and that I might really hit the glass ceiling, but happily the issue did not make waves," he said. Else said it was important for him to send a message to the many young LGBT teens on the verge of being drafted into the IDF. "It's important for them to know there is no glass ceiling that will hold them up in the IDF. Their success depends on them and only them. It is possible to rise to the top of the pyramid. The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, is the people's army. It encourages all who want to contribute and grow," he added. "I'll be pleased if many more will walk in my footsteps." In yet another sign of the improving relationship between Israel and Saudi Arabia, Iran's defense minister, Hossein Dagan, accused Saudi Arabia of cozying up to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. In recent years, Saudi Arabia has very quietly established closer ties with Israel as a sane actor in an otherwise chaotic and crazed Islamist-riled Middle East. "We have previously reported on Too Jewish about Saudi newspapers, all under government control, publicly condemning Hamas and other terrorist attackers of Israel in the past 3 years, something that would never have happened before the Arab Spring shook the region. The Iranian public condemnation of Saudi Arabia is also an indication of just how far the relationship between the two Muslim powers has fallen in recent years." Speaking in an interview last week, Dagan asks the rulers of Riyadh, "Do the interests of the Muslim nations lie in unity with either Israel or America? Will handing the region over to America bring security to Muslims?" The Iranian defense minister also uttered nuclear threats against Saudi Arabia, a verbal tactic previously reserved for what Iran calls the Zionist entity. When asked whether Saudi Arabia is capable of striking Iran, Dagan said, "I do not understand how they would do this. They think that they have an air force capable of doing something, but I advise them not to do anything stupid. But if they do, I doubt that any place in Saudi Arabia will remain intact, with the exception of Mecca and Medina." In other international news of the Middle East, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused Israel of massacres, quote-unquote, against Palestinians and chided the international community for silence on this supposed subject. Erdogan made his comments last week at the Al-Quds Forum in Istanbul, a two-day international event for representatives of foundations, experts, academics, ministers, and high-ranking officials from around the world discussing the state of the Muslim heritage in Jerusalem. Speaking about Israel, the Turkish leader said they feel they are immune to any punishment for their crimes, but the international community needs to stand up against them. It's impossible to establish peace in the region if international law remains indifferent to massacres and cruelty. Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs responded to Erdogan's comment. "Those who systematically violate human rights in their own country should not preach to the only true democracy in the region. Israel consistently protects total freedom of worship for Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and will continue to do so, despite the baseless slander launched against it." Although Turkey and Israel have partially repaired a damaged relationship that once was quite close, Erdogan continues to make inflammatory statements. The Turkish leader survived a coup 2 years ago. He has consolidated power dramatically since then, arresting huge numbers of journalists. After his narrow victory in a recent referendum, he has vastly increased his control of the government and is becoming a true dictator. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Mati Friedman is the author of the Aleppo Codex and the more recent book, Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story. An excellent journalist with an international reputation. We started talking about Pumpkin Flowers, the soldier story of the Lebanese War. And I remember, you know, vividly the withdrawal from Lebanon, and everybody at the time seemed so relieved, and this was going to be a great choice because Israel had continued to take casualties in that security zone, in that buffer area you described so well earlier in the show. It didn't work out that way. There's been another war with Lebanon subsequently, another sort of 21st century kind of conflict. Wait, did you go back there, and what did you feel?
Well, I think that in the 90s, many Israelis interpreted Hezbollah, which was Israel's main enemy in South Lebanon, as being a kind of Viet Cong, meaning an ideological group that was interested in a specific piece of land. So if you cede the piece of land, then the war will be over. Right? The Viet Cong wants South Vietnam. So if you leave South Vietnam, the war will end. And many Israelis thought that would be the case in South Lebanon as well. And that was largely the justification for the protest movement and for the pullout in 2000. But the war didn't end. I think it's because we misunderstood the enemy's motivation. Hezbollah is not like the Viet Cong. It's a group with a religious script and sees the war against Israel as part of a broader religious vision and a way of life. And they're quite explicit about it. There's a very interesting book written by the Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah in which he lays out the belief system, the belief that the war against Israel or against other enemies is a way of building what he calls a resistance society, so society mobilized for perpetual war, more or less, in which a young men see death in battle as the attainment of a religious ideal. So when Hezbollah spoke with this kind of rhetoric, many of us in Israel, you know, kind of rationalist or left-leaning people like myself, we used to dismiss this kind of rhetoric as being just bad rhetoric that masked more practical goals. And of course, once we were out of South Lebanon, this would be over and everyone would get on with building their country. But it turns out that groups like Hezbollah and their many ideological cousins and imitators, they mean what they say when they describe their religious faith and when they describe the way military action fits into that faith. They're quite serious, and we need to take it seriously. And I think that had we taken the rhetoric of Hezbollah or Hamas or Iran or other players, similar players in the region, more seriously in the 90s, we might have chosen to act differently.
And maybe more successfully. The Aleppo Codex traces, first of all, a fascinating book with one of the most interesting histories of all. And you unearthed essentially new information about it. Tell us why you wrote the Aleppo Codex and what your discoveries, what the most surprising of the discoveries were when you began to research it.
When I was a reporter for the AP in Jerusalem, most of our job was covering the conflict and politics, and I found it all quite circular and kind of boring after a while. And I discovered that one way of getting out of doing the regular conflict coverage was to cover biblical archaeology, because there are a lot of people who are interested in that, and I could kind of get away with it. And I also found it fascinating. Of course, I was always on the lookout for stories about ancient artifacts. And one day at the Israel Museum here in Jerusalem, I stumbled on a manuscript that's kept in the basement of the Shrine of the Book, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls are housed. So in the main gallery at the Shrine of the Book are the famous Qumran scrolls, and everyone comes to the museum sees them, of course, and that gallery is always full. And underneath that room is a different room with a different manuscript that's much less full. And that manuscript is the Aleppo Codex. And I understood from the labels on the wall that this is an incredibly important manuscript, that it might be Judaism's most important book, and yet I'd never heard of it. And I grew up in an educated Jewish home, and I'd never heard of this manuscript, which is the perfect copy of the Bible in Hebrew. And I found a gap between its importance and its relative anonymity to be very interesting. So I wrote a story about it for the AP. This was in the fall of 2008. And then I decided I wanted to write more about it. And as soon as I tried to advance beyond the very scant information that was available at the time, doors started slamming in my face. People wouldn't speak to me. I tried to talk to the academics who are in charge of the codex, and they weren't interested in speaking to me. And I tried to speak to Jews from Aleppo, Syria, who also have a very deep and interesting connection to this book, and they wouldn't speak to me. And I realized that there was something here. There was some kind of story here. And I spent a couple of years uncovering it. And you know, luckily, I found a story that had somehow never been told. And I think it's a pretty amazing one.
You know, it's fascinating. The Aleppo Codex, until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, was the closest we got to the most ancient text. And, of course, it's more inclusive. You found stuff that people were hiding.
Right. So the Codex has just an amazing biography. It's written in Tiberias around the year 930, and it travels to Jerusalem, and it gets stolen by the Crusaders and ransomed by the Jews of Cairo, and ends up in Aleppo in a safe, and spends about 600 years in a safe in the Great Synagogue of Aleppo. And after a riot in Aleppo in 1947 that followed the UN vote on the partition of Palestine, the manuscript disappears. My book is a journalistic investigation into what happened to the manuscript after it disappeared. And it turns out that there are a few mysteries connected to the story, a few unanswered questions about the manuscript. For example, how did it move from a safe in the Great Synagogue of Aleppo to Jerusalem, kind of mysteriously resurfaced in Jerusalem 10 years later? And the story of how that happened had never been told, in part because the story is a ton of dirty and unpleasant and very, very interesting, the kind of story that journalists like and government officials like less. And the other mystery is what happened to about 200 of its pages.
Right.
So when it resurfaces in Jerusalem, having once consisted of about 500 pages, each one of them basically priceless, when it resurfaces here in Jerusalem, 200 pages are missing, and no one seems to know exactly how that happened. And there are a few stories about how the pages disappeared, and then the stories are fiction that designed, I think, to obscure what really happened. And the story of the missing pages for many Bible scholars and manuscript collectors, the missing pages of the Codex are kind of holy grail. And I kind of delved into the subculture of collectors and scholars and rabbis and people who whose eyes light up when you mention the Aleppo Codex, and I had a fascinating time researching this story.
It's an amazing story. Less amazing, you've been a working journalist for a long time. The way Israel is portrayed in the international media, now you know how the international media works. People are looking for a story. They're looking for an angle on something they report frequently. Why do you think there's such an inherent tendency to depict Israel negatively when it's not warranted in the international media? And how do you view it differently than the way others do?
I spent 5.5 years as a correspondent here for the Associated Press, which is the big American news agency. It's one of the biggest news organizations in the world. And I initially began my time as a correspondent as a believer in the international press system. I didn't go in cynical, and being an Israeli of the left, I didn't have any particular problem with the angle on the story. And I left. I ended my time there. Very disillusioned and quite angry about what I'd seen. And the story of this place is both blown out of proportion in terms of the scale of events, and it's also warped. The story is warped beyond recognition, to the point where I, as someone who knows this place, could no longer recognize, by the time I finished my time at the AP at the end of 2011, I couldn't recognize the place I knew in the news copy I was writing. The gap was just so wide, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it anymore. The causes are complex. I mean, one thing that's going on here is that this is a really easy story to cover. It's a very safe conflict. I mean, the number of fatalities in the Israel-Palestinian conflict last year is about 1/6 of the homicides in Los Angeles County, or 1/3 of the homicides in Baltimore. So we're talking about a conflict that is real. It's a real conflict, and I wouldn't want to belittle it. I live in the middle of it with 4 kids, and it can be quite stressful. But in terms of the death toll, it doesn't even rank, you know, we don't need to compare it to other conflicts, which would be too easy. It's actually a less deadly place than many American cities, and yet it's covered as if it's the most important story in the world. It's the biggest, you know, international story running over the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And in part, that's just because it's a very easy story to cover. Israel's a nice place to live, and it's a safe country. Israel will let you cover everything, unlike, you know, most regimes on Earth. Right. You can cover a conflict quite safely and in comfort, and that, I think, is one of the main drivers of it. And I think the deeper level of this is that the world is very hard to understand. So if you try to confront the confusing, just bewildering, and often very depressing events on planet Earth, it's overwhelming. So what you need to do as an observer of the world is simplify or choose an example that you can focus on. And you need an example of that kind of illustrates the issues that preoccupy you and your society. So I think what people have created, or what journalists have created, and activists and ideologues of different kinds, what they've created here in Israel is a simplified symbol of conflict, where you have a strong side and a weak side, you have an oppressor and an oppressed, and it's largely fictional, but very, very powerful. So the way this is done is just by leaving out all the context that would be necessary to understand Israel's actions. For example, you'll never see in a news story that the West Bank is a 90-minute drive from Syria. Those two conflicts are reported as if they have nothing to do with each other, and that's right. To enable this kind of simplified David and Goliath scenario, which pushes very deep buttons for people in the West, and that explains the very unique outrage and hysteria that surrounds Israel's actions, which doesn't result from the actions of Russia or Turkey or the United States.
I remember sitting in Şanlıurfa, Turkey, I don't know, maybe 10 kilometers from the Syrian border, in front of a table of American correspondents. And I heard one guy talking about how he'd just been in the West Bank, and he thought, and that the problem in the whole Middle East was Israel occupying the West Bank. And I thought he was maybe, 7 miles from like 500,000 Syrian refugees who were fleeing a civil war that had nothing to do with Israel, and he thought the biggest problem was Gaza and the West Bank.
I think that's representative, and that was often my experience in the press corps here. There's a belief in the centrality of this conflict, or in the unique kind of moral turpitude of Jews in Israel, which suggests to people that whatever is happening in the Middle East, and there's carnage, of course, across the Middle East, that the real problem is this country. And if something could just be done about this country, it would have some kind of supernatural effect on the rest of the region. And that kind of thinking is theology. It has very little to do with geopolitics or journalism. And yet I think it's one of the main drivers of journalism. I mean, for example, when I started to work at the AP in 2006, we had 40 full-time news staffers covering this place. And I'm not counting administrative staff. I'm talking about people who are actually in the field covering the news. And the entire AP staff in Syria at that time was one part-time stringer who had been approved for the AP by the Assad regime. Mm. So the thinking that attributes to this place 40 times the importance of Syria before the civil war happens is one of the reasons that millions of people around the world can't understand what's happening in the Middle East. Because if you think that Israel is the most important country in the Middle East, and this conflict is the most important conflict, when this country is in fact 1/5 of 1% of the landmass of the Arab world, if you think it's the most important part of the Middle East, you're going to have a real hard time understanding the world.
I want to thank Mati Friedman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. We could talk a great deal longer. Where can people go to find out more about your books and your work?
You can check out my website, just my name, MatiFriedman.com, and you'll find links to the books, links to articles, links to upcoming events in the state.
Mati, thank you so much. Looking forward to seeing you here. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Yonatan Ner, filmmaker of the wonderful Israeli movie My Hero Brother. And of course, listen to all of our Two Jewish Podcasts on iTunes or at our TwoJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Gad Elbaz, his song about keeping the faith, Lishmor et Hatikva, protect the hope. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace. ומישהו השתגע, הקפיא את השעות אני זוכר ימים שלו זורמים אליי כמו מים ועכשיו מרוב תפילות כבר לא רואים שמיים החיים שלנו פה הם כמו גלגל ענק בין אש ואדמה, בין בית ומרחק ואיך זה שהיום נפלנו על ברכיים פתאום מרוב דמעות כבר לא רואים עיניים מה עוד נשאר לנו מלבד האמונה?
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.